smother it. Productivity, not stifle it. If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Freedom and the dignity of the individual have been more available and assured here than in any other place on earth. The price for this freedom at times has been high, but we have never been unwilling to pay that price.
Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is December the 29th, 2021. And almost 1 year ago, I had the privilege of doing a podcast with London, UK lawyer, Diane Gellin, who specializes in expatriation law. And there's been a lot of discussion on Twitter the last few days about the inability. People cannot get renunciation appointments, the fees, and the general perception that U.S. citizenship has become an extremely abusive thing for Americans abroad. And today, Diane and I are going to do an update on these issues. How are you today, Diane?
I'm just fine sitting here in the edges of England.
On the very edges.
On the very edges, overlooking the English Channel.
Oh my God, that sounds like a great place to be, actually. Especially
not bad.
With all that's going on in the world. So you have a great scenic beauty. You are basically separated from the interaction of the big city and all that good stuff, I guess.
Yeah, my contact with the big city is, as we're doing now, via Zoom and being other kinds of media.
Okay. So, and I gather you would see that as a way of sort of staying safe in the COVID environment that we're living in?
Yeah, it's sort of crazy. I hear it's crazy out there in London. I don't know what it's doing in Toronto.
It's crazy. It's
crazy. Yeah, high numbers.
Yeah.
Thankfully, not that many people are dying. That's all we can hope for.
Sure, sure. So you have been there the whole time, the holiday season, sitting beside
me? I have, indeed. I've been here pretty much straight since March of 2020.
Okay. Well, the bad news, maybe you've been in one place since 2020. The good news is it does sound like a very nice place to be. So
I'm very lucky.
Good. But even through a global pandemic, Diane, it's like the demand to renounce U.S. citizenship has, well, never been higher.
I'm certainly still getting phone calls and people contacting me who want to relinquish their citizenship. And I keep adding them to my long list of, people who want to do so.
Mm-hmm. When we talked a year ago, we were, I suppose, in the middle of, what was a complete shutdown for renunciation appointments. In Canada, things have actually gotten better. They are open. They're trying to aggressively clear the backlog. People are not being given a lot of notice for appointments, but I know personally people who have, appointments in the next month or so at every available location in Canada. Now, I understand that things have not moved in the UK. Is that correct?
Well, that's not true. I did have two clients who had appointments back in March, beginning of April 2020, which were canceled and who have now relinquished their citizenship. So they have, as far as I'm aware, they have cleared their backlog. But they have not taken on any, they've not opened it up for new people who want to relinquish their citizenship.
Okay, so that's a fundamental difference between the way it's being handled in Canada. And I think Canada and the UK are good comparisons because I think that probably the Toronto and London UK consulates are, you know, our locations are probably the two biggest in the world for renunciations. That would be my guess. Mm-hmm. After the shutdown in March 2020, the process in Canada was such that people could still get their information in, their forms filled out, and their names on the list, but that has not been the case in the UK. So they may have cleared the backlog in the UK, but basically they're not taking appointments. Is that your
understanding? They're not taking appointments. They're not making a list. They're not creating a list. They're not allowing people to send in their any kind of information or data about themselves, or even that they have an intention to relinquish their citizenship. I can't even imagine what's going to happen once they do open it up. I don't know if it's going to be some huge free for all, and you know, it's like getting tickets to a Beatles concert or something back in 1965. I don't know how they're going to do it. First come, yeah. First serve.
Well, maybe they could auction them off. I mean, I've always thought even at $2,350, I mean, the value of if that's what you pay for a CLN, I think it's grossly, grossly undervalued compared to what it's worth in the world today. Any yeah. thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, costing them $2,350 to get that certificate of loss of nationality. That's not, you know, that's something that's substantial. That's a substantial amount.
It is substantial.
But that doesn't stop anybody from doing it. I think even if the fee was higher, I'm not advocating for that. And I don't think there should be a fee attached, because I can't imagine that the administrative part of this is that costly.
Oh, I think it's pretty clear that the fee charged does not relate to the cost of the service at all. I mean, it's impossible that it could.
Right. You know, they totally agree.
I mean, they're basically doing nothing. Plus, I mean, I think the clear proof of that, and we've talked about this before, is that it costs far less to become a U.S. citizen. You know, when they're to naturalize, you know, there's all this background, this and that, and the interviews, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this whole thing is, you know, just one more example of, you know, just frankly being nasty and punitive to people who want to renounce. And it's, you know, it's really a tragedy because, you know, in my view, I don't think people want to renounce U.S. citizenship. I think they're just being forced out by the regulatory regime. I mean, is, you know, comment on that, if you would. Is that your experience?
I mean, I always say it's not like the sort of 60s or 70s where somebody was so pissed off with Vietnam War or some kind of U.S. foreign policy. Those are not the comments that I get from people. It's not about who's president, who's not president. It has nothing to do with the political climate. It has everything to do with, you know, people's personal circumstances, whether that be they just want to be subject to the tax regime in one country, or they just want their estate tax issues to be regularized so they don't have to think about issues in two different countries. They might be married to a non-US person. It's all for ease of making their life easier. And there's really no client of mine who has said to me, I hate the United States, I want to leave. It's not about that. It is about, you know, ease of their lifestyle. And if that could be made easier, none of these people would be relinquishing their citizenship.
Well, I think that's right. It's so complicated to be a U.S. citizen, I think generally, but particularly living outside the United States, you really need to have like a full-time lawyer in the family. You know, or have it, you know, like, you know, your phone number, Diane, hard coded into their phone or something, you know, on some kind of a monthly payment planner.
There's too many pitfalls. There's too many ways that people can be caught out, things that they have to think about when you have to think about laws of two different countries that, although, you know, I mean, you live in Canada, I live in the UK. We generally speak the same language as those, you know, of those who live in the United States, but we don't. I mean, the laws are different. things are different, and it's, you know, and sometimes it's impossible to see those differences.
Well, you see them once you've been issued a $10,000 penalty. You know, you would.
Yes.
About. I mean, you know, that's an interesting problem too.
Yeah.
You know, it's really unfortunate because I think that, I mean, I really would like to state, and I'm sure that you would agree, that I think that U.S. citizenship does have value. You know, I mean, this seems to me there's little doubt about that. I mean, it is a citizenship and a, you know, it's considered to be a first world democracy. I mean, there are obvious employment opportunities, you know, et cetera. But, you know, people are being forced out. And I think that, you know, I love your views on this. Like, I think it's the middle class and the lower middle class who are primarily the victims of this.
Now, I think you're probably right about that. You know, there are a lot of ways to deal with tax issues, for example, that, you know, that you're right. The middle class is the one that is being hardest hit. Those who want to, you know, set up savings accounts in the UK, have the benefits of certain kinds of tax savings that are available to, you know, to hardworking people who then don't get any of those benefits, because if they, you know, are able to use the tax benefits of the UK, they'll find themselves being taxed on that in the US. Or if they invest in certain kinds of US tax-free products, they're going to find that they're taxed on that in the UK. And it is that sort of middle group of people who just want to do right by their life, who just want to, you know, sort of lead a safe and, you know, save for the future and for their children. And they're the ones who are being most hit by this. It's not the wealthy.
Yeah. And to be very clear on this point, and I'm assuming you would agree, but I'm interested in your confirmation on this. People are renouncing because they want to be in compliance with laws that they simply
yes.
cannot comply with. You know, it just becomes an impossible situation.
It becomes harder to comply with laws when you are living in two countries, when you have ties to two countries where the laws are different. And
yeah.
Therefore, it makes it difficult to comply with both at the same time. And that's what happens to Americans who live abroad.
Well, and for those who are able to comply with both at the same time, it comes, I think, at a very significant opportunity cost. Because, for example, let's take, you know, a very easy example. In Canada, there's something called a TFSA, which generally, correctly or incorrectly, is understood to be taxable in the U.S. Basically, the income on it is a retirement-type product. The income is not taxable in Canada, but is taxable in the U.S. So the effect of this is that for people who want to, you know, essentially survive under two tax systems, their perception is that they lose the benefit of the TFSA, right? They lose the benefit
mm-hmm.
you know, a very important retirement planning vehicle in Canada. Or in Canada, the principal residence is clearly, the gain on the principal residence is clearly a retirement planning vehicle, because the sale of a principal resident yields a capital gain that is not taxable in Canada. And, you know, for U.S.
Right, which is the same in the U.K.
Yeah.
It's
so,
not
I mean,
a taxable event.
You know, I think the principle is that people cannot take advantage of the things they are encouraged to take advantage of, right? You know, in Canada and the UK, right? So it's, you know, I've almost come to see middle-class Americans abroad as being in a permanent state of, I would say, downward economic mobility.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the issue is that you don't get the advantage of either country's what I call tax perks. Tax-free events.
Every country, you know, I know we've sort of gone into tax a little bit here, which I don't know that that's where we really started out from, but my view is that
each country has its own tax laws. Fine. I have no idea which ones work any better than the other. I don't know if it's better to be able to die and leave $11.2 million or $3 million to the next generation, or is it better that you can only leave £320,000 tax-free as you can here in the UK? But as you move through life here in the UK, there are many benefits that you have in terms of, you know, not paying capital gains tax on the sale of a principal residence. And there are other, you know, everybody organizes their tax affairs, you know, in a way that benefits them. What happens is that when you live in two different taxing regimes, you get neither benefit. So you don't get a benefit of, you know, dying and leaving 11.2 million to the next generation. Because you're living in the UK and the rules are completely different. So you don't get any benefit. And it's really therefore hard to plan your life when you're in two different, very much opposing tax systems. And that's what I hear most of all from people who want to relinquish their citizenship. It's like, you know, don't tell me, you know, that the estate tax is better in the United States. Don't tell me that that regime is better, because I'm living here. This is where my life is. I'm, you know, married perhaps to a British national. I've got children who may or may not be, you know, dual citizens. Don't tell me that it might be better tax-wise in the U.S. That's not where I live. I live here, and I have to follow the rules here, and I want to plan for it, and therefore I want to relinquish my U.S. citizenship. I don't really want to relinquish it, but it makes more sense for me to do so and be stuck in only one regime.
Well, to that I would add, you know, often I hear sort of, you know, I have an obligation to my family, you know, to do right by them. This type of problem carries into the family. You know, you talk about a U.S. citizen in the U.K. married to a British national, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, once you have marriages and things like that, I mean, this U.S. citizenship problem is not localized to the individual. It's transmitted mm-hmm. right into the family. And
and people are concerned about that. I had a conversation only a couple of days ago with a youngish, well, I call everybody young, who's, you know, around 30 years old, just recently got married who's an American citizen through his mother, and recently married a British national, and now they're thinking about, well, what do I need to do? Now that I'm an American, I've married a non-American, and what are the things that I need to think about? And these shouldn't be things that they have to think about. You know, being an American should not be like, you know, having lice in your hair. We should be able to embrace our Americanness.
That's right. And, you know, over the last, certainly, since the start of the 21st century, there is no question but that the U.S. government is absolutely destroying the value of U.S. citizenship. It probably, because of this regulatory regime, it may be the only citizenship in the world that's actually worth renouncing.
Right.
They're just sort of, you know, not a neutral thing in the background. But let me ask you this. You know, you and I have known each other for, I don't know, would it be 7 or 8 years or some a while? Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, at this point. And, you know, we've kind of talked around this issue. I don't know if we've ever actually discussed this. Does it benefit the United States in any way, shape, or form to have the citizenship taxation regime?
I can't imagine that it does. I can't imagine that it makes that, you know, that there's that much tax revenue that comes from Americans abroad. You know, our votes don't count. You know, I can't believe that our tax dollars count.
Mm-hmm. And then they certainly, they certainly have no, like, I don't know. I mean, they certainly don't feel positive towards Americans abroad. I think that some in government feel negative, but probably most feel neutral. And does it really make sense for them to be making laws that affect people who they're not even considering? You know, I mean, you know, this is really, you know, it doesn't even meet the first test, I think, of basic legislative morality, does it?
I didn't know the words of legislative and morality go together, but certainly doesn't in this case.
Diane, I'm thinking theoretically. Was it Dworkin or was it Rawls who said that, you know, that what equal protection meant in law was the equal care and concern of the legislature? I think it was Dworkin, actually. But I mean, I often think, I never understood that, by the way, until I started trying to figure out these problems for Americans abroad. But it's you know, it's really significant. Do you think that, do you think there's the likelihood of any change in this? Or do you think that, you know, this is just something that, well, it's always been there, and therefore it will always be there, you know, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I mean, there has been some talk, and there's certainly, you know, lobbying going on to change some of the tax laws, but I don't think it's fully understood by those in our sitting in Washington, D.C., what it really means to an American living outside the U.S. I don't think they understand what that means on a day-to-day basis. They barely understand what it means, you know, for an American citizen living in the United States to go into a grocery store. How are they going to ever understand what it means for an American living abroad who's facing, you know, laws in two different countries that are opposed to each other?
They're absolutely clueless. I mean, I think a lot of Americans think that America invented the concept of taxation and that only America has taxes, you know, or something like that. But what they clearly do not understand is that the way this operates has in effect created a very separate and far more punitive tax system for Americans abroad than for resident Americans. I mean, it's astonishing that, I mean, most people are absolutely astonished by the concept that U.S. citizens living outside the U.S. are subject to U.S. taxation in sort of the same way that Eritreans are, right?
Right.
But they never
it's talk. It's a hard concept to understand and to get across to people. And especially, you know, I mean, I'm still seeing people who were born in the United States who then moved back here with their British parents who may have been in the United States for, you know, a year or less studying or doing a postdoctoral degree or something. You know, this poor child came back here and suddenly now at the age of 30 or 40 or whatever is realizing that they have this responsibility to file a U.S. tax return. And, you know, they're still dumbstruck by this idea. And there's still so many people who are being, you know, who are just realizing it now. I mean, it's not something that was, you know, you should have figured it out 5 years ago. People are still, you know, only now just sort of figuring it out.
Yeah, well,
figuring it out through the banking laws primarily.
Through the whole FATCA thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one thing FATCA has accomplished is gotten the banks around the world to sort of hunt down people with a U.S. birthplace and tell them, you know, that, boy, they better get a Social Security number and file U.S. taxes, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible situation. Like you. You know, when I was in law school, or even 15 years ago, I never would have imagined that this would be, you know, what I'd be spending a good part of my time doing, you know, is helping people out of the whole U.S. tax. Well, it's more than the tax problem. And by the way, to be clear, these people generally don't pay a lot in U.S. taxes. I mean, there are some who do, you know, for varying reasons, but generally speaking, they don't even pay a lot in U.S. taxes. I mean, most of them actually pay
no U.S. tax.
Are you their tax?
They're paying all of their tax here in the UK. You know, and they don't have investments in the United States. They're paying no or virtually very little U.S. tax. So that's why I can't imagine that it's, you know, such a big deal to, you know, to change the tax laws and to regularize it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, the foreign tax credit rules. I mean, that would be true from your vantage point in the UK, certainly my vantage point in Canada, you know, any of these high tax countries, I don't know. I mean, what if you get in the Middle East where they have no income taxes? I don't know.
Or even I've got a client who works in Russia who, you know, pays 10% tax. And then he, you know, tops it up to 39% in the US.
Yeah. It's, I mean, you know, those are people who probably need to get out because, you know, the point here, I think, is that every country, you know, I think has sovereignty over its general economy and, you know, how the tax system is used essentially to manage the economy. I mean, taxes have gotten so pervasive that they're no longer in the background. I mean, they are, you know, the number one issue in how the economy runs. And, you know, as taxation and the complexity of the tax system has increased, certainly the damage done to Americans abroad has increased as well because of that. But anyway, people have got to get out. You know, that's pretty
people clear. Have got to get out. And, you know, and the question is can they get an appointment and do they have to personally appear?
Yeah,
you know, making a formal renunciation of nationality before a diplomatic or consular officer. What does the word before mean?
Yeah, so let me just read in what the law actually says for our discussion, the exact text of the law. So this is section 349A of the Immigration Nationality Act, titled Loss of Nationality by Native-Born or Naturalized Citizen. Covers voluntary acts of burden of proof and presumptions. But it begins by saying, a person who is a national of the United States, whether by birth or naturalization, shall lose his nationality by voluntarily performing any of the following acts with the intention of relinquishing United States nationality. And let's go down to the five, because that's the renunciation one, which says making a formal renunciation of nationality before a diplomatic or consular officer of the United States in a foreign state in such form as may be prescribed by the Secretary of State. Now, I want to ask you first, okay, that can you confirm, okay, that it's that statute that governs it at the end of the day, that is what the law is?
As I know, that's what the law is. I mean, that's, you know, how I read it.
Okay, so it says before a diplomatic or consular, it says, okay, in a foreign state. So when we know a renunciation has to be done outside the United States, it has to be a formal, whatever that means, before a diplomatic or consular officer. And I do not, and we've discussed this before, I do not see any language in there that says that it has to be inside a consulate. Do you?
No. As I keep saying, it can be in a coffee shop, it can be in a lobby, it can be out on the street.
So, for example, you could take the local consular officer out for lunch.
That's right. I think, okay. Yes.
I think that's right. It continues, though, in saying, essentially now what they've done is they've delegated to the Secretary of State and the language in such form, well, this is the United States, so it has to be a form, in such form as may be prescribed by the Secretary of State. Now, I would understand that to be, all right, so the law is whatever's going on, it's got to be outside the United States. It's got to be done before a diplomatic or consular office. And we're going to let the Secretary of State make up the rules for how that works. Does that seem like a thing?
That seems right to me, and a prescribed form or some kind of format.
Okay. So this business about the State Department claiming a year ago you read in a letter that you got from the embassy in London, basically saying, oh, come on, you know, they have to do this in the embassy, blah, 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 you know, in person.
Right.
But it seems to me that language, as may be prescribed by the Secretary of State, it's really the State Department who's the culprit here, not the law itself, right?
Correct. Well, that's right. Mm-hmm. They can prescribe the rules.
Right.
Or the formality.
Okay. So basically, it seems to me, and it's great to get your thoughts because, you know, you think about this stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the State Department could just say, nope, we're going to, people don't have to come in. In fact, we don't want people coming in anymore because of the whole COVID thing. In fact, in the interest of saving, in the interest of the health of the diplomatic and consular officers of the great United States of America, we are going to prohibit people from coming in to renounce, and we are going to require them to do it by video conferencing. Could they do that?
I would think that they could, as may be prescribed by the Secretary of State, if that's what they choose to do.
Yeah,
Why not? I asked them before, could we have a Zoom meeting? And there were the response from the consular officer or, you know, somebody working in the consulate was, you know, sorry, we're not allowed to do that. You have to personally appear. But it doesn't say you have to personally appear.
I agree. It says with
renunciation of nationality before a diplomatic or consular officer. Doesn't say in person. Doesn't say where.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you're certainly preaching to the converted or to the choir. I think you're 100% right on that. And I think what's important is how to interpret this information that comes from the State Department, well, you know, from the consulates or embassies via the State Department, is simply that we don't have to, but we've simply made a policy decision that this has to be done in this way. So it's actually not the law. It's something they've decided, and they can clearly undecide it.
I agree with you, and I wish they would.
Oh, God, I think everybody wished they would, for sure. Now, in this context, after we talked last November, there's been at least one lawsuit, and I think two, brought by the Accidental Americans Association against the State Department over these renunciation issues. One of them is, to reopen embassies in Europe, for example, for renunciation. I think the fact that this is going on in Canada may actually strengthen their case, but do you think that perhaps they should amend the claim to allow it to be done by video conferencing?
I think video conferencing, I mean, we do a lot of things now by video conferencing. I mean, I can even, you know, certify documents by video conferencing.
Yeah. I listened to our podcast from a year ago, just before meeting with you today. And at that point I commented, and I will recomment that, you know, people are becoming Canadian citizens. Their Canadian citizenship naturalization ceremonies are through Zoom.
And the same here. We have Zoom citizenship ceremonies.
Yeah. So, I mean, this stuff is entirely doable. So, I mean, honestly, it's really, really, really hard to interpret this stuff as being anything other than, you know, at best indifference. And at worst, just sheer out and out nastiness on this issue.
Well, I think they're taking the view that the resources that most of the people, as I understand it, most of the people at the embassy here are still working from home, but they do have limited resources to which they have not wanted to assign anybody to do renunciation. You can get a new passport. You can register the birth of a child. You can do several, you know, it's hard to get an appointment because they're so limited, but you can get appointments, and they are letting people into the embassy, just not for this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually said to a client recently, get an appointment, do anything you can to get an appointment. Doesn't matter what the appointment is, go in there with your renunciation documents and in front of a consular officer, sign the documents and hand back your passport. They were a bit, but nobody's taken me up on that offer yet.
Actually, I think that is incredibly interesting. Would you mind repeating that?
I said to a client recently that make an appointment at the embassy. It doesn't matter for what. Pretend you have a child, pretend you need a, you know, passport, whatever it is, get inside the embassy, take your documents with you. Saying that you wish to relinquish your citizenship, take your U.S. passport, and in front of whoever you're seeing, a consular officer,
hand them your document, sign the document and hand it to them and say, I hereby relinquish my U.S. citizenship. What are they going to say to them? What are they going to say?
Or how about better yet, or slight improvement? How about please accept this as my formal renunciation of nationality?
Even better, let's get the word
a
formal renunciation.
Officer of the United States in the United Kingdom in form DS-40, which is the prescribed renunciation form. And for good measure, here is DS-4081. And I'm signing this in front of you. So help me God. How does that sound?
Sounds perfect to me. I just, you know, I would love somebody to try it on.
I think that, you know, now that is that
because what are they going to say? You know, I guess what they'll say is, I'm sorry, I can't accept it. And, you know, and my retort is leave the documents with them, including your U.S. passport. And as you say, I am making a formal renunciation of nationality. I'm done.
That's interesting, Diane. This is one of the reasons that, you know, I like doing these podcasts with you and why I regard you as one of the best expatriation lawyers on the planet. That's good. Of course they're going to resist it. But I think it, at a minimum, it makes a very, very important statement. You know, in our podcast last year, you and I both expressed an opinion that people had a constitutional right to renounce, I think.
We talked about that. I don't know if they have a constitutional right, but I think anybody has a right to relinquish their citizenship. It's enshrined in law. I hereby wish to relinquish my citizenship. There's no, you know, and there are many ways that you can relinquish your citizenship. Making a formal, you know, renunciation, you know, formal, taking a formal oath before a consular officer is only one of them. I mean, there are other ways that you can relinquish your citizenship so long as it's coupled with intent, including, you know, serving in the armed forces of a foreign state and serving the government of a foreign state, or even taking on citizenship of a foreign state. All of those are possible, you know, ways that you can renounce, you know, your citizenship, so long as you have intent. You know, it's not about burning the flag. It's not about, you know, ripping up your passport. You have to do it in one of these prescribed ways. So there are these prescribed ways. So do you have a constitutional right? I don't know if you have a constitutional right, but you certainly have a right under this particular law to relinquish your citizenship. And that right is being denied to, you know, hundreds, thousands of people around the world right now.
All right. So I'm going to ask you this, and I sort of apologize in advance, but please understand this question is evidence of my respect for you. Okay.
Okay.
Because this is probably not an easy question at all. But since I've got you on the podcast, Diane, let's assume for a minute that a case like Euphorium can be interpreted to mean that people have a constitutional right to renounce U.S. citizenship. Now, I know you're not committing to that, but let's just assume that the case is read in that way, which I think is a plausible interpretation of it. Now, would that mean that I think we would agree that 349A prescribes ways that are perhaps safe harbor ways of definitely relinquishing U.S. citizenship? But I'm wondering if, assuming there's a constitutional right to renounce, that one could interpret it so that those were not the only ways, okay, that those were just ways that were guaranteed, but other ways of doing it, you know, might be successful. For example, you may recall the persecution of Bobby Fischer after he committed the cardinal sin of playing chess in Belgrade. Right? Can you imagine anything as un-American as that? What a reversal. In the 70s, Kissinger was begging Fischer to go to Iceland to play. Okay? Come the 90s, oh my God, if you go to Belgrade to play, you know, you're subject to this, that, and the other thing. Apparently, Mr. Fischer attempted to renounce U.S. citizenship from his cell of incarceration in Japan. Do you think that there's a possibility that if there's a constitutional right to renounce U.S. citizenship, that anything that evidenced the voluntariness and the intent, which is probably a requirement under the Constitution, would constitute a relinquishment of U.S. citizenship. In other words, you know, they really got to get their act together here. They're holding people prisoners of U.S. Yes. citizenship. Sooner or later.
I think the two crucial words are voluntarily and intention to, you know, and having the intent.
Right. So now let's go back to I think I'm going to refer to that as in 349A, there are seven ways of relinquishing. I'm going to informally add a number eight, which I'm going to call the Diane Gellin method. Okay.
Okay.
But let's say that somebody goes in and does the Diane Gellin and just says, you know, here it is. It's voluntary. It's intentional, blah, blah, blah. And they say, well, no. You know, you haven't met five, you know, properly. And the answer is, well, I have a constitutional right to renounce. And this is what Diane said I should do. All right. And the point is that it's voluntary and intentional. I mean, maybe that's how one argues that it works. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it works. I mean, if you read the statute again, making a formal renunciation of nationality before a diplomatic or consular officer in such form as may be prescribed, they're giving them the forms.
Prescribe the form. We know they prescribed the DS 4080 and the 4081, right?
That's right. Those are the forms I hereby relinquish. You know, you have to say that out loud when you're having appointments now at the embassy here. You say those words out loud. Used to have to say them out loud, but now they ask you to say them out loud.
Let's create the wording right now. Okay, well, we'll repeat it. I think I did it a minute ago, but let's see if we can get it right now. Okay.
You have the form in front of you? I don't.
No. Okay, how about this? Okay, in accordance with the language in DS 4080, which is the prescribed oath of renunciation, I so-and-so appear a U.S. national by birth with my U.S. passport to prove it, appear before you, a clear consular officer of the great United States of America in the United Kingdom. And I confirm that I voluntarily renounce my US citizenship with the clear intention of no longer having any of the benefits of US citizenship. How about that?
Sounds good to me.
All right, you're gonna be
fan. How can somebody deny that statement and say, no, I'm sorry, I'm the wrong person. You can't do it in front of me.
Exactly right. I think that's exactly right. Well, that is interesting because, you know, I've been thinking a long time about this problem of, you know, if they won't allow you to renounce formally, they're holding you a prisoner of U.S. citizenship. There's got to be a way to get rid of it.
Against your will. They're holding you against your will.
Exactly. Well, I mean, they clearly are doing that. And, you know, a lot of people may not want to hear that, but, you know, as going back to, we started with Ronald Reagan, maybe it'll come to an end. Ronald Reagan used to say facts are stubborn things. Okay. And, you know, this is a fact that they are holding people in U.S. citizenship against their will. I think there's no doubt about mm-hmm. this.
And didn't he say the price for freedom is high? So here
well,
we
that's
are.
Right. He said, you know, the price of our freedom has sometimes been high, but we have never been unwilling to pay that price. Those of you who are upset about the $2,350 renunciation fee or the exit tax, remember that Ronald Reagan would say, you go ahead and pay. Price of your freedom is high, but
we have to add to that of what else they have to do. They have to bring in cash for $2,350 when they go to the embassy. And here's my fee. I've paid my fee. Although it's that's prescribed, that might.
Yeah, I think I they guess probably at the moment should that do that's that. Prescribed. They probably should do that. They probably should do that, even though I don't read that into this. There's nothing in the statute that requires that.
No, but it may, as in the words, as may be prescribed by the Secretary of State.
Yeah,
and we know what the fee is.
Could well be. In other words, in such form, if the word such form include the payment of a fee.
Right.
But, you know, yeah, absolutely. Let's give them the $2,350. In fact, give them a tip. Give them a right. tip. And say, you know what? We're going to give you an extra $1,000because
I'm a nice person.
As a souvenir of this being 349A8, the new Diane Gallen approach. You know, or something of that nature. But,
all right. Well, maybe I can actually find a client who will try this on.
I suspect that there are some who will try this on. You know, if for no other reason, but a lot of people are. You know, the longer this goes on, I mean, what they're by holding people prisoner, they're creating covered expatriates.
Right. Right.
You know, which is another kind of problem. But anyway. Diane, this has been an incredible conversation. I really enjoyed this. And I think that a lot of people are going to find this enormously interesting. Do you have other thoughts?
I think not at the moment. I think, you know, I just wish they would open it up. It would just, you know, I don't understand why they can have other consular activities going on for other reasons and not this. It just makes those people second-class citizens.
Well, you know, the thing about Americans abroad is that they are second-class citizens everywhere in the world. Everywhere in the world. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. In America, everywhere else, I mean, they're seen as pariahs, you know, costing a bunch of money. I mean,
right.
You know, probably it's probably history will show that it's going to become a new area of psychotherapy, psychological counseling for the American abroad, which actually is a very serious problem.
I'm laughing, but you're right. It is serious.
Yeah. Diane, and people get a hold of you. How?
Best by email, as usual, to Diane@DianeGellin.com.
I think you should create a new email address to use along with that, Diane. How about 349A8 at DianeGellin.com.
All right. Well, I'll get on to that.
All right. Anyway, this has been great. Thanks so much for having this conversation.
Thanks, John. I always enjoy talking to you. I always learn a lot. It's always fun, you know.
likewise. And we'll definitely have to keep going on this one. This is so interesting.
Sounds all right, good. Diane. Happy New Year and stay safe.
Happy New Year to you too. Yeah. See ya.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.